right, we're ready to get underway, and tonight what we're going to do is look at the Book of Ruth, a wonderful story. The Book of Ruth takes place during the time of the Judges. The chronicler tells us ancient Jewish tradition says that Samuel was the chronicler of 1st and 2nd Samuel and of Ruth, but that's and of Judges, not 1st and 2nd Samuel, because that would be after his lifetime, but Judges and Ruth. But there's no way to know that. It's a tradition. The only thing is, it's as ancient a tradition as you're going to get. A guess today is way far removed. And so most people just call the writer of these books Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, the chronicler, the storyteller. And so who it is, well, we just don't know. If we're going to understand the Book of Ruth and its place in the Old Testament, you have to understand the concept of the kinsman redeemer. Remember how important the land was. It was assigned by tribe first, and then clan, and finally family. And it was God's intention that no one be able to put together great swaths of land and control the situation. So you had the year of Jubilee. After 50 years, it's got to revert to the original owner. So all you can do in the meantime, really, is lease it. Now Israel didn't follow that, but that was the theme. Later on, kings took over, and so you have the story of Ahab, and Naboth's vineyard is an example of that. But the land was important because it was here that God was going to redeem His people and the world. So, if you didn't have an heir, a son that was an heir, because the biggest problem was the husband dies. Well, now what? Where does that leave the widow? She needs a male heir. So the law of the levirate, that's Latin, vir is man or husband, and legis is law. So the law of the husbands, and in this case, it's a brother takes a wife if he is available and can provide her with an heir. That way, the land that belongs to her can be passed on. Otherwise, it can't be passed on. But the other possibility for taking care of that is that one of the kinsmen could be a redeemer, a buybacker, so that if her land, for example, let's say her husband dies and she doesn't have a son, she can't farm the land. That's not going to work. So someone would buy it, or under perfect circumstances, lease it, and raise a crop on it, but she wouldn't get any income, or very little, depending on how everything worked out. But she could have a kinsman redeemer whose obligation it was to buy the property for her. That way she would get some income from it, if everything worked out the way it was supposed to. And then if she had an heir, a son, then the land could be passed on. Now, this really gets complicated, and we can't get into every permutation of this. And not only that, it didn't always work out the way it was supposed to work out, because the children of Israel didn't necessarily follow the law. But the law of the kinsman redeemer plays a major part in the story of Ruth, Naomi, Boaz. Now, think about that. A kinsman redeemer. this is really a picture of the Messiah. So the Messiah has to be a kinsman. God can't use his almighty power and rescue us. Now, I'm not interested in getting into the argument, is there anything that God can't do because he's omnipotent? That you don't get to look at things from God's point of view. The simple fact is that God can't win our hearts with power. And he wants to win us back. So the Messiah becomes a kinsman. He becomes a human being. Now, that doesn't directly play a role in the story of Ruth, because there it's the Old Testament idea of the kinsman redeemer. But Ruth becomes a part of the genealogy of Jesus. And so this concept of the kinsman redeemer is a type of Christ. All right. So let's take a look at the story. It's hard to tell when this takes place. However, there is one line in the story in which the chronicler feels it necessary to explain a custom. Well, you wouldn't explain a custom that was 50 years old. Your readers would understand it. So people guess, then particularly if Samuel is the author of Ruth, that the book of Ruth was written very late in the time of the judges, or even as a story having to do with David becoming king. That would be the time of Samuel, for example. So if Samuel wrote it, for just guessing, can't be certain of that, shortly after David was anointed king, then Samuel would have been trying to legitimize David, support him, legitimize him, that sounds bad. But people were not necessarily, they could be supporting Saul yet and not supporting David. And Samuel would be interested in putting forth David as king. So he gives this story of genealogy that ends up with David and includes the story of Ruth. The story of Ruth is actually shorter than the story of Gideon. It could well have been a part of the book of Judges. It happened during that time. But it doesn't fit with the pattern of the book of Judges. The book of Judges is a book that tells us the story of the decline of Israel. Things are going downhill. And there's this constant pattern of the children of Israel being rebellious and so forth. Well, the story of Ruth is not a downer at all. And so that may very well be why it wouldn't be included in the book of Judges, because it wouldn't fit there. It would just stand out. So it's put on its own. All right, there's some background. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. That's a common thing. The rains don't fall. We can survive that much better than they can, because we've got dams and wells and things like that. If it doesn't rain, it only takes a year and you're in deep doo-doo, you know. Okay, so famines could be long. If they were long, they were particularly bad. Or, like in the days of Ahab, King Ahab and Elijah, it didn't rain a drop for 3.5 years. Now, that wouldn't necessarily, it's still a famine if you get the winter rains come, but you don't get very much. 50% of normal. I mean, we get this, you know, we understand this. All right. And a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. Now, Moab is not far away, and so questions have been raised. You know, why is there a famine in Bethlehem but not in Moab? Because it's just across the Great Rift Valley there, the Dead Sea, and there's Moab.
in the days when not a great deal of geography was understood, I mean, like 100 years ago, and people didn't go to the Canaan, to the Promised Land, to Israel, very much, there was just a question raised about that. But the plains of Moab are way higher than the land of Judah, where Bethlehem Ephrathah is. And so you can easily have a situation in which the rain doesn't fall in Judah, but when it reaches those higher plains from the Mediterranean, it's raining there, or more at any rate. So he can't get along, so he leaves his land. Apparently he has no other choice, and the chronicler doesn't tell us any of those details. That just lengthens the story. But he leaves. Now, that does not mean that he loses his land, but somebody's going to take it over. They're not going to leave it sit there. You can't disinherit anyone. That was at least not according to the law of God. And it isn't anyone, it's a family, not just one individual. All right, the man's name was Elimelech. Interesting name during the period of the judges, when the Lord is ruling his people, not particularly successfully because of the people. But Elimelech's name is God is King. So exactly what Israel wasn't doing or honoring was Elimelech's name. Names have importance. You've got to be careful, you know, finally what's in a name. But the man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites. So that's Bethlehem Ephrathah. That's the region immediately around Bethlehem, which would identify his inheritance. They're Ephrathites. And they went to Moab and lived there. There's no indication that they intended to be there forever, but perhaps the famine went longer than they might have hoped. Who knows? We don't even know what it's like. Now, Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died. It's a testosterone problem. He just bumps off. And she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. Again, the children of Israel were forbidden to marry Canaanites, but they could marry Moabites, but there was still, it took 10 generations, presumably, before they, if you had Moabite blood, before it was completely accepted. Moab is a descendant of Lot, back, so they're relatives. And so when she heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, which means it rained, Naomi and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. Now, whether or not, clearly Ruth intended to return, Orpah, but you in the Middle East, you never say goodbye to someone in the house. You go with them part way on the journey. It can be a kind of a nice gesture, you know, a mile or something. But you might go to the boundary of the country or something like that. But you never said goodbye inside the house unless you couldn't move. That's just, and it's still true today.
In China, you get escorted to the train station and on to the train.
There you go. Right, okay. All right, so that's part of hospitality. And we're much shorter, to put it nicely, than other societies. We don't put much stock in the niceties. All right, so they're going to return. And the words in Hebrew don't say whether the two women or not are intending to return. that comes up in the story. With her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living. So it's a sad situation. She's gone to a foreign country, she's lost her husband, and she's lost both of her sons, and she's left with these two daughters-in-law. And she says, well, I need to go back home. The people in Moab don't have any concern, I mean, any built-in blood concern for her. So they set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. Then Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. That as widows, that's where they would go. They would return to their mother's home. Well, we'll see why Naomi says that. May the Lord show kindness to you as you have shown to your dead, her two sons, and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. The word rest there is the word for Sabbath. It's the word for rest in the promised land. And it can have a deep spiritual meaning, but it can simply be you're safe. Rest is especially, I mean, you go to the promised land because there, that's the place where God is going to provide for you. But it just means rest. It's just interesting. It seems this passages like this drive late 20th century and 21st century people nuts because it seems to say that the only way that you can have a life is to be married. Well, which was exactly the case. It's not patriarchal. They didn't have any problems worrying about homosexual marriage. Everybody got married. You know, this is what you did because that's what life is about. Now, we believe that life is not that much about children. So you do whatever makes you happy. That's the really important thing. All right. Then she kissed them, and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. Well, I think in the case of Orpah, that's a nice thing to say. We'll take you all the way back. It's what she would be expected to say. And then Ruth is going to say, no, you don't have to do that. But again, there's no way to know what's behind the things that are said, and it's not that critical. So we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who would become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband, even if I thought there was still hope for me. Even if I had a husband tonight and gave birth to sons, would you wait till they grew up? See, it's just, you know, this is not going to work. And if you want to have a happiness in your life, you need to go back to your mother's homes. Would you remain unmarried for them? I should have added that in. Of course you're not. You're a whole time of being able to bear children, and apparently neither one of these women bore children. So whatever happened to them when they got to Moab happened very quickly. Unless both of them happened to be childless, but we know that Ruth wasn't. I mean, barren. Things went bad very quickly for Naomi, and in various places in the story, we can feel and hear her bitterness. No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. Now, how do we interpret that? You know, there's really two ways to interpret that. You can say she's despairing, she's blaming the Lord, or it's simply the belief that what happens rests in the Lord's hand, and the Lord's hand has gone out against me. It isn't a judgment of whether God has rejected or it's simply the fact. So if you see everything as being in the Lord's hand, then the Lord's hand has gone out against her. And whether she's complaining or not, and of course she is. I mean, you know, but we don't have to have her having a crisis of faith and she's about to abandon the Lord or something like that. It's very bad. She's lost her husband and two sons, apparently, in a very short time, period of time. At this they wept again. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her. See, and then we learn another thing. The gods, Israel is unique because it sees her God as the God of the nations. Israel's God is the God of everyone. He's the creator of the world. But that's not the way people in that part of the world viewed things. They were their gods. And they had their own ideas. Other people had their ideas, and it didn't make any difference to them. I mean, it isn't like our ideas are right and yours are wrong. Our ideas are our ideas about the laws and about the gods, and your ideas are your ideas. And that's fine. But along comes Israel and says, no, your ideas about God are completely wrong. Isaiah, you're carting your gods around in a wheelbarrow. Our God reigns in the heavens. So the Jews were not especially liked for that, and the Jews had problems with that. The way that the children of Israel went for the gods of the Canaanites can seem to us to be really stiff-necked. And they were. I mean, God calls them stiff-necked and uncircumcised, you know, so they are. But we almost can't understand it. You know, how could they be so thick-headed? All God wants them to do is trust in Him. But, you know, and all let's see, this is, 3,500 years ago, let's say, because we have to guess at the time. A little less than that, 3,200 years ago. David in the year 1000 is 3,000 years ago, and maybe it's a couple of hundred years before that, something like that. All right, nothing's changed. The children of Israel never abandoned God. They thought that God, Jehovah, was the God of the really big things and of the crises. You know, you need to get out of Egypt, God will defeat Egypt for you. But, you know, when it comes to the everyday things in life, you gotta hedge your bets a little bit. You know, you gotta deal with what is. And nothing, you know, we're exactly the same. If you really get into trouble, it drives you into the arms of the Lord and your faith is strengthened. When everything is going well, then we bring out our idols, you know. And we haven't abandoned the Lord, you know. We just need these. Now, the children in the days of the children of Israel, they thought that life was controlled by gods. Israel thought that life was controlled by the Lord. We often don't think that. You know, our problem is that our idols aren't really gods, they're just extensions of ourselves, which the idols in ancient times were too. I mean, it's not that different. But they worship gods. We worship money. We worship pleasure. We worship freedom, independence, the ability to do whatever I want, whenever I want to do it. You know, those are our gods. Those people back there weren't that dumb. They knew that there were gods. They just couldn't figure out what was true. So,
Naomi says to Orpah and to Ruth, go back to your gods.
She's going back to her people and her gods. There's no future for you in Israel because you're a Moabitess. You need to be with your people. And you can't come to Israel unless you abandon your God. So Naomi, whatever else she is, I mean, we don't know everything about her, people will ask, well, why did they ever leave Israel? Well, Abraham did right after he got there. As soon as there was a drought, he went to Egypt, you know. So let's not be too hard on Elimelech and his wife Naomi. But at any rate, for whatever reason they went, and they probably only intended to be temporary, but so did Abraham, they went. So there it is. Deal with it. But Naomi is a very pious woman. And she knows that there's no future for Ruth as a Moabitess. But what has happened, apparently, in this short period of time is that the bond between Naomi and Ruth has grown very strong, and Ruth has come to believe in God. We see that. Here's what happens. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. I know it's a polite thing for you to do, but I'm not going back. That's what she's saying. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. I'm not just going to escort you back. I'm going to stay with you. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And those two go together, don't they? In the Old Testament, you can't be a worshiper of the God, the Holy One of Israel, without being a part of Israel. It would be like us saying today, your God will be my God, and your congregation will be my congregation, or your people will be my people, and the people will be the people of the church, not of a nation. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. That's the final commitment. Remember Joseph? Joseph makes his sons promise that when they go back to the promised land, they'll take Joseph's body with them and bury him, because that's the place of God's salvation. All right, and that was not just singular to Israel either. So I will die there and I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. That's an oath, isn't it? I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. So help me God. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if anything but death separates you and me. When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So, okay, going to accept this. So the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them, and the women explained, can this be Naomi? My goodness, she's back. Remember, they hadn't been emailing in the meantime. Can this be Naomi? And Naomi's answer, boy, don't call me Naomi, which is related to the word pleasant. She told them, call me Mara, which is bitter, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. And again, I think that we need the statement stands on its own. Does it mean that she's abandoned her faith? No, it doesn't mean that, but she's bitter. It's been a tough road to hoe. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune against me.
So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. And the whole story is going to be over by the time the wheat harvest is at an end. And the barley harvest would begin at Passover, and the wheat harvest would be Pentecost. So during the 7 Sundays of our Easter time, or the Feast of Weeks, it was called in the Old Testament, this whole story takes place. Very short. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech. See, that's very important. A man of standing whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, so first the chronicler just tells the story. Now look, we have to know that there's this Boaz, and he's a man of standing, and he is a kinsman to Naomi. Now the story continues. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor. Now, why is she saying that? Well, first of all, it's just nice behavior by a daughter-in-law. She's asking permission. It's maybe perhaps Naomi accepting her fate. I mean, she owned land. But now she comes back and there's no male. She can't take over her land. So Ruth has to go out and glean. And the law of the Mosaic law in Leviticus says that you can't harvest the fields clean as a whistle. You have to leave behind what isn't just picked up in the normal course of affairs for the poor. So Naomi says to her, go ahead, my daughter. So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. Now, the harvesters are not the creme de la creme of society. You know, in harvest time, you need more workers than you do otherwise. So your servants live in your home, but at harvest time, you're hiring day laborers. And they're a rough bunch. I think that's important in the story. So she's working behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. Well, you know, he's looking out for his land. He wants to know how things are going. So he greets the harvesters, and in a very, the usual way, the Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they called back. So this is a standard pious greeting. Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, whose young woman is that? Now we begin to read into the story. Is he curious? Or is he, who is this young woman? Whose young woman is that? And, you know, the chronicler, just, you know, when you tell a story, you don't have to spell everything out. So the foreman replied, she is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. Ooh, whoops, the law didn't say you could gather among the sheaves. You know, so she, now maybe she doesn't know the law that well, or maybe it's the attractive young woman who gets stopped by the cop and who is, she needs to get some grain for her and Ruth, and she maybe is flirting with the foreman, or who knows. But, you know, the gleaning is according to the law, not gathering among the sheaves. She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning until now, except for a short rest in the shelter. That verse, we can't get into that. That verse is really strange in Hebrew. It's like
the foreman starts to stutter, and there's just words, and there are different ways to interpret it. And one of the thoughts is that he has allowed her to glean on, among the sheaves, and the foreman would not expect that the owner would be particularly happy about that. So in the Hebrew, it sounds like he's stuttering and he's not putting together single thoughts. Really interesting. And of course, then the foreman is surprised that it isn't bothering Boaz at all, see? So what's going on? I mean, who knows? It doesn't change the story any, but it needs to be a real story. All right. So Boaz said to Ruth, "My daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you." So we got these harvesters out there, and this is risky, and Boaz says to the workers, you know, anything goes off here that's out of line, and there'll be hell to pay, you know. So he didn't just tell them, he made clear that, so Boaz is smitten, let's just face it. All right. And wherever you are, and whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. You don't need to take care of that yourself. At this, she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, "Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?" Boaz replied, "I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband." But notice before that he didn't recognize her. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't make sense. It could very well be that he's looking at her from a distance and he doesn't really know who it is. But in the village of Bethlehem, how can a high-standing guy not know what everybody is talking about? And he's heard about her. So I think that's what we just have to assume. All right. "So I've heard about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before." That's a tough choice to make. And so he compliments her. Oh, of course he compliments her. All right. All right. "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge." So he's a very pious guy, isn't he? I mean, he's a good man. "May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord," she said. So notice that she doesn't demur. She doesn't, no, that's, you're offering me too much. No. Okay. "You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls." Now, in the Middle East, it's very important not to put yourself forward. So these are exactly the right things to say. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, "Come over here. Have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar." You know, they would carry bread. That was their basic nourishment. The wine vinegar, if you're working in the hot sun, dipping the bread in the wine vinegar would cut through the glup in your mouth and would be refreshing. I'm reading this. I haven't particularly done it. I know I like olive oil and balsamic vinegar. So I don't know, you know. Okay, but what I read in the commentaries is that this was a common thing, and especially in the heat, it would clear your mouth, and so when you drank something, it would be refreshing. All right. "When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain." They took grain, this would be last year's crop, and put it on a pan and then roasted it in a kiln. and it's much tastier. You know, it's chewy, or crunchy is a better term than chewy, and it brings out the flavor. You know, if you cooking does that, doesn't it? I mean, if you in the wintertime you go and get a tomato that isn't like the ones raised in the summertime, and if you slice it and put it on your sandwich, it's so-so. But if you cook it in any way, its flavor is enhanced, and grain is like that. It's crunchy and it's good. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. As she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men, "Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her." They all know what's going on here, right? Okay. "Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her." So Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, which means she just, you know, threshed it, and so that she wouldn't carry the stalks home. She's just gathering up the stalks and she threshes it, so she's only got grain. And it amounted to about an ephah, half a bushel. And measurements are always difficult, but it's a fair amount. That would be enough for, I'm told in the commentaries, half a bushel of grain to make 20 loaves of bread. So it's a considerable amount. So Ruth, she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Whoa, that's better than gleaning. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. So I've got some nice roasted grain for you here, too. That'll be tasty. Her mother-in-law asked you, "Where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you." Now, you know, suppose you're making a movie of this. I think that what happens in this scene is that Ruth, with her body language and her, you know, the way she's talking about this, is excited, and Naomi is picking up on this. You know, "Where were you?" And, "Oh, blessed be the man who took notice of you." Interesting. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. "The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz," she said. "The Lord bless him," Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. "He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead." The dead being her husband first, but also Ruth's husband. She added, "That man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. He's in line." So Naomi, I mean, we could make this into a kind of devious thing, but there's nothing devious about it. She's got great difficulty, and if somebody's going to buy back her land, it has to be one of these kinsmen redeemers. All right. This might work out pretty well.
Quick study.
Yeah. Then Ruth the Moabitess said, "He even said to me, 'Stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain,'" which means you can come back again, because it isn't all done in a single day. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girls, because in someone else's field you might be harmed." Well, I mean, you know, you just got to take the words, but it's like Naomi is saying, she picks up on Ruth liking Boaz, and so she says, "Well, it's really good for you to be there. I mean, you know, because somewhere else you could be harmed." But it's also true that she could be harmed because Boaz was warning his men, you know, so whatever. So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. Now, that last sentence there is really a framework for the rest of the story. It's not like we get to all the way to the end of the wheat harvest and now this happens. It just says she stayed there. She kept coming back.
And now what happens during this time? One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for?" Well, what does that mean?
Get her married.
Yes, got to have a husband, right. "Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours?" He's a real possibility. We just think, that's from a later time, but we have to, what's the, no, I can't even think of it, the matchmaker. We need the matchmaker. All right, but that's Tevye. Okay. "Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor." So this would take us to the end of the barley harvest and approaching the wheat harvest.
What's winnowing?
Winnowing, the floor is made on a high spot. It's made out of clay, and they apply water and smooth it out and let it dry and do it repeatedly, and then they sweep off the dust. And then you put the grain on there, and you pull across it. It's called a threshing sledge, a weighted thing with a flat bottom that squeezes the grain without crushing it, but knocks it off of the stalks and takes the chaff off. Well, now you got a whole pile of wheat and chaff. You can rake up the stalks. Then in the late afternoon, in desert, the wind blows this time pretty reliably and regularly, and you have a winnowing fork. And you take the grain, it's close tines, you take the grain and you throw them up into the air. And the wind carries the chaff down the hill, down the side of the hill. So winnowing is getting rid of the chaff. John the Baptist says, the Lord is coming, his winnowing fork is in his hand. Are you wheat or chaff? He doesn't say, are you wheat or chaff? But that's, you know, the chaff will be burned up in the fire. So that's winnowing. All right, good question. Oops, lost my place. Okay, here we go. All right, now Naomi says, we got to get serious here. And, I mean, he's giving the signals, but who's the gatekeeper in relationships?
The woman.
The woman is. So what Naomi is saying to Ruth is, he's giving you the signals. You've got to let him know what the situation is. And we're in trouble. There isn't time for all the niceties. Now I'm really interpreting here, and you can decide what happens. Okay, so what goes? "Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying." So she's to go there at the end of the day. And he's out there for the barley harvest. He's working in the fields. I mean, he's not that rich. And he's sleeping out there because crack of dawn, they're up at it again. It's harvest time. You got to get it in. So Naomi says, you're going to have to be forward. Go and apparently, I don't know, maybe her being there wouldn't be that big a deal. That's hard to say. But what she's saying is take note of where he lies down to sleep, because it's going to get dark. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. So uncovering his feet, you can take that to mean something pretty racy, but there's no reason to believe that. But it would be forward. It's in any case, it's forward. So she tells him. Naomi tells Ruth to do this, and she says, it's going to work. He will tell you what to do. Well, he could tell her to bug off. "I will do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do.
When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, and it's, you know, he's working, he's not drunk. I mean, I think that's too much. He's the guy who's running things. He's not going to have a hangover for the next day. But they're drinking wine, and it's a nice day. They got lots of work done, whatever. I mean, whatever they're feeling, and they've had something to eat, and now you get tired and you go to sleep. So he went down to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. So it seems as if he's taken the spot where he's watching over the grain. Nobody's going to come at night and steal the grain. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man. You know, and maybe he thought he heard somebody's got to watch out for the grain, whatever. And he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Now, there's no lights. It's pitch dark. "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." So, this is bold and brash. It's the same phrase, remember earlier in Ruth here, where Boaz had said, the Lord, may the Lord spread his wing over you. It's the same phrase. She's telling him, look, if you're really interested, I am too, you know. "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier." I presume that means the kindness that he showed to Naomi, that he had complimented her on. But look what he says. "You have not run after the younger men." Things aren't much different over the centuries, are they? "Whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask." So I'm delighted. This is fine with me. "All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I." So that's a little bit of a problem, because there's an order, and this other guy is closer in relation to Elimelech, Naomi's husband, and he has the right of what do we say that
first refusal.
I couldn't think of the word right. So stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning. Now, this guy, there's all kinds of things that are possible here. The matter of his buying back the property may be one thing. How much is involved in does he have to take her as wife? Is that even a consideration? Take Ruth as wife. And it's hard to tell. But he's promised that he will be the kinsman redeemer, and Ruth is worried about Naomi. That's been her concern all along. And he says, you're treating me as kindly as you treated Naomi. So it may be that he's just thinking of the purchase of this property, which would give Naomi yes and no. But if the right guy buys it, that's obviously a good thing. And if he's going to marry Ruth, which he's going to do, then if Ruth has a child, then Naomi gets her property back. See? It's not her versus the little child, because they're all one family. But now Naomi can own the property, because Boaz is there, and there is a male heir. I mean, everything is cleared up. Okay. So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. So in the darkness she left. And he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. So just be quiet about it. Now, you know, there's a couple of things here. It may not be that this would be somehow a little scandalous, perhaps, maybe. I mean, you know. But also, I think he does not want anybody to know what might be up as far as what's going to happen the next day. Mm-hmm. Well, so we'll see. I mean, we're not going to get this all figured out exactly. I think if we lived at the time of the chronicler, it probably would be absolutely clear to us. He also said, bring me the shawl you are wearing and hold it out. When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and put it on her. There's no way to know what 6 measures is. Maybe it's 6 scoops. There are different ways. I mean, by certain measure, it would be 90 pounds. It's not likely that she's going to carry 90 pounds back. But Naomi is Ruth is responsible to Naomi, so he's giving her a gift. I mean, let's take this, and it's just, you know, here, take this grain with you, barley. And he put it on her in a sack, wrapped it up in this article of clothing. Then she went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, how did it go? You know, this is not like the Iliad or the Odyssey, or like inscriptions on Egyptian temples, you know, this high muckety-muck language that nobody cares about. We're interested in this story because it's just like today. How'd it go? What happened? Tell me everything about it, you know. Sleepless in Seattle. You know, the girlfriend who is who. Well, when she comes back from trying to go out to meet this guy in Seattle, she wants to know everything. Tell me everything, you know. It's just an ordinary thing. All right. Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. See, you have to give a gift. So he's thinking of you. And he made the comment about how Ruth had cared for her mother-in-law. Then Naomi said, wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens. So it's like, well, what do we do now? And Naomi says, just wait, you know, you've done what you can do. For the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. I know what he's going to do. He's going to take care of this. Meanwhile, back on the ranch, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat there. Now this is where this is the public square. This is where all the business gets taken care of. So it's early in the morning. Everybody's bustling about. It's the barley harvest, and that's why Naomi also knows that he's going to get this taken care of. He's not going to fool around. He's got to get this taken care of right now. When the kinsman redeemer he had mentioned came along, Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. He just invites him over. I want to talk chat with you. But it's not casual. This is business, because Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, sit here, and they did so. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, so in the presence of witnesses, and you know, it takes 10 to have a synagogue later on. 10 is the number of all of something. So it's a normal thing. Then he said to the kinsman redeemer, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our brother Elimelech. See, and this also tells us that all of this is happening very rapidly. You know, is it just a couple of weeks? I mean, we don't know. Because the land would not lay fallow. Right now, it doesn't make any difference, because whoever planted the barley that might have been on the land or whatever is going to harvest it. He planted it. But the land can't stay up in the air like that, and probably the city fathers decided who would farm it in the meantime. But now she's come back. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. So apparently there's some people who are related to Boaz and some who are neutral.
If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am next in line. There isn't anybody else. You have the right, but I'm next in line. I will redeem it, he said. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi and from Ruth the Moabitess, you acquire the dead man's widow in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. So you have to take this responsibility. Now, does he have a wife? What is his circumstance? At this, the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. Now, one simple explanation is, if he takes Ruth as his wife and has a child, then who's going to inherit? Like if he has his own children and so forth. But, oh my goodness, there are all kinds of different possibilities. I started to write them down and I thought, oh my goodness, it's too complicated and it doesn't make any difference. We don't know what the situation with this guy was. So he says, I might endanger my own estate. Why exactly that's true? There are different explanations. You redeem it yourself, I cannot do it. So if I'm just going to buy this, I think I'll do it. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. Now, that leads us to believe that this is written much later than when the story happened, because apparently it's no longer the way they seal deals, and it has to be explained. So that lends credence to the idea that Samuel is perhaps the author, and he's writing in the time of David, and that this may have happened early in the time of the judges. But, oh man, I'm not remembering the names. I'd have to go back. But there was one of the judges that had to deal with Moab. I remember. And so it's not likely that this all occurred during this time when Moab and Israel were fighting. But we're covering a couple of centuries here, more than that. So the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and he removed his sandal. So he makes the deal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion and Mahlon. Chilion and Mahlon would have been, it's theirs because they would have inherited. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabitess, Mahlon's widow, as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from the town records. Today you are my witnesses. So he makes this official. Then the elders and all those at the gate said, we are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who bore the 12 tribes. That's a way of wishing well. It's a blessing based on the history of Israel. But it's a threefold blessing. So may the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. So may you have a wonderful reputation. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah. So Boaz is in the line of Judah, and Perez is the one who is directly in line.
So that's a wish that, you know, ultimately the woman's seed is going to be born out of the tribe of Judah. So that's a rich blessing. And that's the end of the story. Not quite, but we get this genealogy, this thing leading up to David. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. Oh, happy ending in this story. Then he went to her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, the women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a kinsman redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel." So, you know, may your husband, your daughter's husband, may he have a rich reputation and be successful. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. And a widow needs that. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons. Now, there's a woman's blessing to a woman, huh? Right? Better than seven sons, has given him birth. Then Naomi took the child. So maybe we should go back. Sons are, of course, supposed to take care of mothers, but who takes care of the mothers? No, the daughters-in-law. Yeah, so the daughters in the family who are married off, they're given to the other family. They don't take care of mom. The daughters-in-law do. So he's better, your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons. So that's what's behind that. All right. Then Naomi took the child, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. And remember how the story started. Naomi loses everything. So it's bringing the story full circle. She has her, she can dandle her grandson on her knee. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son." So her name is not Mara any longer. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. This, then, is the family line of Perez. So now we're going back to Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nahshon. Nahshon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. And now this story has become one that is well known in the days of David, and it helps to connect David to the tribe of Judah and to the king who ultimately will come, the house of David. You know, your house will you will reign forever, and of course that's because his offspring Christ Jesus is king forever.
This is just an incidental side of. Oprah was really to have been named Orpah.
Orpah, right.
But
and it got turned around.
On the birth certificate.
I had heard that too. So they're going to name her Oprah.
Orpah.
I got it. Orpah. And turn the letters around. And so she's named Oprah. So, wonderful short story. The story of Ruth is a rich one. And some people will say, well, you always bring Jesus into everything. You know, and that is exactly right. If you read the Old Testament without Jesus, you are a fool. And it is really telling that today Jewish people have no idea whether Jesus is the fulfillment of the Messiah. But especially for Orthodox Jews who are waiting for the Messiah to come, you would think that they would have deep studies of why Jesus is not the Messiah. You know, because they're still looking for the Messiah to come. But here's Jesus claiming, and you would think that we would hear a great deal about why Jesus is not the fulfillment of the scriptures. But in the Talmud, there's a lot of slander of Jesus but there's very little refutation of the evidence in the New Testament that Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies. There's just all kinds of slander. The Talmud is an embarrassment. It stays hidden. And there's things in the Talmud that are just really not very nice at all, in a lot of different ways, not just with Jesus. But you only hear the nice little sayings. The other things get hidden. And in a way that's fair, because it's only the gathered wisdom, and some of the rabbis were wiser than others. That's what somebody who's Jewish would say. But Jewish scholars can't argue with you about whether Jesus is the Messiah by saying, well, he's clearly not the fulfillment of Isaiah's prophecies. They don't discuss that or think about it. And that's telling. Because Jesus is the fulfillment of the Old Testament. All right.